The recording you were about to hear was originally broadcast on August 8, 2012 on the Free School University program on Occupy Boston Radio, obr.fm on your internet browser. This is the Free School University on Occupy Boston Radio, and welcome. And we are educational programming by the 99% for the 99%. I'm David Knutinen. I'm your host. Our producer, Catherine, is also in the studio with us. Hi, Catherine. And tonight's special guest is scientist, activist, and author Richard Levins. Richard Levins has been a tropical farmer, an organizer of Puerto Rican coffee workers, an anti-war organizer, a writer for a monthly review, among other magazines and journals, and a groundbreaking mathematical ecologist. He's the John Rock Professor of Population Sciences at the Harvard School of Public Health. His professional work has involved mathematical modeling of the way in which organisms evolve in together with their environment. At least that's the way I understand that. I'm probably messing that up. He's also applied himself to community development and public health. He's been on the board of directors of Oxfam America and the chair of the subcommittee on Latin America and the Caribbean as part of the New World Agriculture and Ecology Group. He helped to develop modern agroecology, concentrating on the whole system approaches to gentle pest management. So, Professor Levins, Dick, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, you've done, in your lifetime, an awful lot of stuff, and a lot of different areas, and when I was reading, you know, some of your bio stuff, I was just thinking about how in my life, I often have a hard time figuring out which hat I'm wearing. You know, if today I'm the engineer struggling to make a living in the capitalist marketplace, or if I'm the radical socialist activist trying to do whatever little bit I can for a better world. So, do you have the same experience, or have you managed to integrate the parts better than I have?
Actually, it would be harder for me to separate them than to integrate. Uh-huh. I see it as part of one active life. Mm-hmm. Trying to improve our understanding of the world and working to change it.
Mm-hmm. So the connecting theme, I guess, is that understanding. It's actually the 13th thesis, isn't it? Trying to understand the world in order to change it.
Yes, and the thing is that working in the natural sciences gives you a sense of complexity, of the way things are connected.
Mm-hmm.
The difficulty in the natural sciences is convincing people that the world matters.
Mm.
So my role within the scientific community is arguing for the social relevance mm-hmm. of scientific work.
Mm-hmm.
Within the activist community, it's the opposite. It's arguing for the importance of understanding theory.
Mm-hmm.
Because Americans particularly are pragmatists. The word theory is a pejorative term.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to point out that it's really necessary to understand what we're doing. It's not enough to get out there and do.
Mm-hmm. So we were going to talk today about the idea of who owns science. I thought maybe I'd start by playing devil's advocate and say, what does that mean? I mean, science is... It's common property of all, isn't it? Isn't it just there for anybody who brings an inquiring mind and wants to try to understand? What do you mean when you say who owns science?
Well, throughout history, science has belonged to somebody. It could have been the priests in the Mesopotamian temple, or the English gentry of the 18th century, or the corporations and the military. But there's always somebody who decides, first of all, who is allowed to be a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, what are the scientists allowed to work on?
Mm-hmm.
Third, what theories are acceptable and what are ruled out of court? Fourth, how are the results of science applied in the world?
Mm-hmm.
Now, all of these are owned by somebody, and in our present society, it's owned by a consortium of the large corporations, government, particularly the military,
mm-hmm.
and the universities, with universities being supported by government and by the large corporations,
mm-hmm.
providing materials for industry,
mm-hmm.
even personnel who go through the revolving door, working on government panels, testifying before Congress, controlling the publishing mm-hmm. of scientific textbooks, mm-hmm. and determining the agenda of science, so that students entering science look around for funding, look around for fellowships, and these come from the corporations or from government and the military. Mm-hmm. Since they know what their thesis is going to have to be in, they're directed toward the courses that will contribute to their jobs, and so they're discouraged from spreading themselves too thin, from looking at those areas of science that are not going to be providing them with employment.
Mm-hmm. They have to they're encouraged to concentrate.
That's right.
Yep.
So those are some of the ways in which science is owned. Now, some of the ownership involves direct coercion and bribery of scientists, and generally this is in bad flavor. For instance, the New England Journal of Science of Medicine discovered that a large proportion of their articles were funded by corporations, and that work funded by corporations tended to find positive results for the products of those corporations. So we now have a lot of concern with avoiding conflict of interest. Mm-hmm. We have to sign statements every year to the effect that we do not have investments in the companies whose products we might be developing, mm-hmm. so that we don't have a direct financial stake in the particular answers we come up with. And this works to some extent. Where it doesn't work is when there are biases shared by a whole scientific community, mm-hmm. or when the conflict of interest is not between the individual researcher and a particular corporation, but between the community of researchers and the whole array of corporations, the industries that invite you to give seminars, that give you free samples, that give you honors, that publish your works, so that there's what C. Wright Mills described as a power elite of overlapping interests, concerns, and sensibilities, which guides science along pathways that very often serve profit-making rather than the needs of people.
Mm-hmm. So there is, I mean, scientists are aware of this. I mean, you know that some of this, at least some do. I mean, like you just pointed out that the medical journal was trying to correct for that sort of error. But what we are saying is that there's a lot of it is below the conscious level. It's not, people don't know they're even buying into certain biases and so forth.
That's right, because it penetrates the scientific theories as well. Mm-hmm. So, for example, medical research is very often organized around specific diseases mm-hmm. rather than around populations that are exposed to an ensemble of diseases. Nowadays, there's an increased interest in co-infection. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the poor in the world are suffering from co-infection right along. Mm-hmm. We're told to look for the active ingredient in a plant mm-hmm. if it's useful. But what if it's the ensemble of active ingredients? Mm-hmm. That a plant has many secondary chemical compounds. They're used in herbal healing by indigenous peoples. And it may be that it's the use of the whole array of active substances in plants mm-hmm. rather than trying to extract a patentable object. Mm-hmm. So the point is that the way in which you look at disease and treatment is very much dependent on what can be turned into marketable commodities. Mm-hmm. The preference for looking for a molecular answer to a medical problem is one of the manifestations of this philosophy of reductionism, that if you can reduce a problem to its smallest pieces, you can not only understand it but also patent it.
Right.
And as against this, instead of looking at agriculture as a place to market herbicides, fertilizers, and insecticides, you talk about managing an ecosystem where there are many species of plants, some of them crops, some mm-hmm. of them supporting, where they're creating the environment that they grow in by producing shade, by changing the moisture relations, and therefore where the whole system of agriculture, an ecological system compatible with human survival, should be the object of study rather than the attempt to search for the marketable molecule.
Mm-hmm. With pesticides in particular, you've done a lot of work around alternatives to sort of ecological alternatives to pesticides, haven't you?
Yes, my interest has not been exposing the pesticides so much as looking at the alternatives, recognizing that a community of insects includes a pest, competitors of the pest, predators that feed on that pest, maybe predators of the predators that feed on the pest. Mm-hmm. And so when you intervene in a system, you can often get surprising results. For example, a pesticide can increase pests. We know that antibiotics can increase pathogens,
right,
that hospitals can be the focus of infection,
that
our intuition is thwarted when we continue trying to find single, simplified, and marketable solutions.
Is that connected to, you had said you wanted to talk about the sources of error in science. Is that part of that, what you were talking about when you told that?
Yes, well, the first important point is this. At the present time, when fundamentalists are attacking science, it's important not to fall into the trap of saying that science is the golden road to wisdom, that it solves problems, that our science is right, whereas their arguments are false and superstitious. Science is partly right. Science has made some terrible mistakes in its history. Some of them we couldn't help because we didn't have the available knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it because of the biases of the science. Mm-hmm. So human genetics has a long history of being extraordinarily racist and feeding in support for the immigration laws in the United States and for the genocidal programs in Nazi Germany.
I mean, Stephen Jay Gould's book on the mismeasurement of man was a lot about
that. That's right.
A lot about that, yeah.
When I was a graduate student, we were taught that the continents were fixed in place. We were taught that the climate was fixed. And so the problem was, how could organism have originated in a climate like the one we have now? And the answer to that is that they didn't.
They didn't, right.
That they arose and created their own environment.
Right. So the whole environment that we're in is actually a creation of life. I mean, life created.
And this is true at all sorts of levels, that organisms don't simply move into environments. Organisms select their environments, transform their environments, define what's relevant in the environment, create the environment, respond to the environment.
What do you mean by defining what's relevant? It's a little bit, the rest of it seemed to be clear, but that's...
Well, we are middle-sized organisms, and gravity is an important part of our lives.
Right.
Things fall down, we fall down, we have to move around.
Mm-hmm.
For bacteria, gravity is irrelevant. They're too small, and what's relevant is surface tension.
Mm-hmm.
Or we talk about climate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, where is the climate? In the weather box at the local airport? Or within a centimeter of the soil surface.
Mm-hmm.
Ants going along on the surface are moving in an environment that's quite different from what we do.
And it changes quite a bit as they move around, too, right? There's a lot of variation.
The changes are so finely grained that when it gets too hot, an ant can stand up on its hind legs and place its head in a cooler environment. Around a tomato plant, the shade and the temperature will be different on different leaves. So there are spiders that live on the lower leaves of a tomato. There are those that live on the upper leaves. So what's relevant in the environment, what we ask about, depends on the organism.
I see.
And for us, who are social as well as biological, the social-political environment is an important issue. So when we think about regulating the blood sugar in our bodies, the obvious things to think about are things like insulin and adrenaline. But it's also your metabolic rate, the pace of work, whether you have the freedom to take a break when you're tired, whether there's a foreman who's going to move in and push you to work faster, whether it's a union shop with a shop steward who could intercept the foreman. All of this is part of the regulation of the body's sugar content.
Mm-hmm.
So we always have to consider, in any scientific problem, where does the rest of the world fit in?
Mm-hmm.
What is this particular object of interest connected to? And no matter how small the problem that you're forced to work on, you can always ask these bigger questions.
Right.
Where does it come from? How did it get this way? It wasn't always this way. It came from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Need it always be this way? What else could it do?
Mm-hmm.
How could we change it?
Mm-hmm.
So these are questions which expand the work in the laboratory to see the connections between our laboratory and fine-scale work and the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm. And that's those are the kind of connections that probably are often obscured with the university model of science, where it's, everything's broken into the tiniest minutiae of divisions.
That's the case. Even in the study of disease, veterinarians are only beginning to talk to doctors,
mm-hmm.
and plant pathologists are still pretty much out of the loop.
Right.
Plant pathologists are at state universities in small cities.
Right.
Doctors are in private universities in giant cities.
Mm-hmm.
They don't read the same journals.
Mm-hmm.
They don't go to the same meetings.
Mm-hmm.
With a few exceptions. With some notable exceptions.
Yes. Of course, it's a struggle to change this. Now ProMed, which is the web service on arising disease problems,
uh-huh.
will include animal and plant questions.
Uh-huh.
But this is something which is relatively new. 20 or 30 years ago.
Even people in the medical field who work on sort of public health problems tend to be very much separated from people who work on treatment of disease. Isn't that true?
That is true. It's also true that 20 or 30 years ago, medical students were taught that infectious disease had been conquered. Now, this is an interesting question. I've spent a lot of work analyzing it because the people who are arguing that there's no longer an infectious disease problem are people who are just as smart as I am and well-funded, well-read, and yet they got it all wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So we analyze what is the structure of their error. First of all, they ignored other organisms and thought only of people. If they had looked at diseases in wildlife, in farm animals, and in plants, they would see that there were new upsurges of disease constantly.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't look at the evolution of the microorganisms themselves and therefore didn't realize that when we invent something to control a disease, they invent something to get around it.
Mm-hmm.
They do it by mutation, by occasional recombination.
Yeah, I was going to say inventing is maybe not really the right term to use. But
yes. Yes. But what it means is that the age of antibiotics may be ending.
Hmm.
It's only been around for 100 years or so as a major way of approaching disease.
Mm-hmm.
But already there are very few antibiotics in the pipeline. The organisms adapt to them very quickly. They're overused, and therefore the adaptation is increased,
mm-hmm.
and they're distributed at hospitals.
Mm.
So the way in which we approach disease doesn't look at how do we as a species stand in our relation with the microbial world.
Mm-hmm.
Another kind of error was to consider that things are the way they've always been.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't realize that every change in our relations with nature, with economic development, with agriculture, with urbanization, is also changing the context of evolution of the microorganisms. For instance, you need enough people, perhaps 250,000 people in a population, to sustain measles. Because measles will affect people, kill some, the survivors are immune, and there's nobody left to infect unless you have enough children coming in.
Mm-hmm.
So there are diseases that were probably not affecting humans when we were hunter-gatherers.
Uh-huh.
In those days, diseases would spill over into people the way encephalitis does nowadays. When you had the large cities of the Industrial Revolution, London...
When you say spill over, you mean like from a...
Invade,
like from a pest into a particular group, but it wouldn't have the groups themselves wouldn't be large enough for them to spread and go epidemic through, is that...
That there'll be diseases of other organisms.
Yeah.
And when there are enough people around, then they could spread and colonize people.
Right. So instead of getting the disease from a mosquito, you start to get it from other people if the population is big enough.
No, it's that we create cities where the mosquitoes can thrive.
I see. Okay.
So, friends, it turns out that mosquitoes need partial shade. The ones that are most responsible for malaria do best in partial shade, and therefore they increase in deforestation. They live in the canals, irrigation canals, in the pots of water, flower pots that people have. Sometimes the memorial flower pots that people put in cemeteries. They'll live on pollen. Mosquito larvae can feed on corn pollen. So when you're growing corn, that's one of the things to worry about. Are there puddles with pollen where the mosquitoes might feed? In Ethiopia, this seems to be an important problem. So every change in the environment that we cause is also changing the circumstances of evolution for all the other creatures around. Another kind of error is the failure to consider that epidemiology is a social as well as a biological science, that different sections of society have different patterns of exposure. I remember in Puerto Rico that you can identify the homes of the engineers and managers because they had screens on the windows. So different social strata have different degrees of exposure. Malnutrition changes the vulnerability of people. Okay, the message then is that in order to understand our own future as a species, the question of whether we'll survive as a species, we have to see us as changing the environment that we try to adapt to. But in a better sense, I'm wrong in using the word we. 10,000 years ago, people adopted agriculture. And soon afterward, there were class societies. There were the rulers and the ruled. And once that happens, the rulers and the ruled have different interests. And we can no longer talk about we.
Although the rulers like to use that word a lot.
That's right. We would like the urban water supply to be clean. They'll just as well go out and buy water.
Right.
Even though it turns out that the purchased water isn't all that clean. Soon they'll be having oxygen tanks in the living room.
I'm trying to figure out what they're going to do with all of their beachfront property.
That's right. So they'll bring in bulldozers and create new beaches.
And they're doing that. They're in certain beaches, they're bringing in sand to keep in Massachusetts, to keep these very nice houses from falling into the ocean.
Right. Then what are you going to do with the canyons of California, which are a perfect setup for channeling the winds that channel fire? So then the rulers like to pass the responsibility for well-being, for their well-being, on the general public, but ignore the threats to the population as a whole. And this is true in industry, occupational health, in urbanization and where people live, in where people spend their time in general, what products they use. At the present time, there's a struggle in Washington, state of Washington, about using herbicides against some of the wetland species that are regarded as immigrant species and therefore not allowable for our biodiversity. I suspect that the current worry about invasive species is really a projection about their worry about immigrants who are imported because we don't have enough workers and then kicked out because we have too many.
Right.
And do you mind if I ask, just when you say that, just to how you would back that up? Because I think some people think that, of course, invasive species are doing economic damage, and some of them are, but the difference between, I guess, species that are non-native invasives, and the whole kind of discussion of native versus non-native, you know, and native invasives, or native plants that tend to take over, like, and I guess how there's maybe a little more complexity than our listeners might realize in that dynamic.
Yes. But first we have to know that species move around. Species come from different parts of the world. For instance, peppers and tomatoes and potatoes, they're an important part of the Chinese diet, are all American plants brought by the Portuguese to China.
Mm-hmm.
And there are plants in the New World, and particularly animals. Cattle came into the New World with the Spaniards and with tuberculosis and with other diseases. Commerce brings along rats and along with them the fleas and plague. So the history of the world is one of species moving around.
Including our own.
Yes.
Very much
so. And we could ask, are we a weed? But the question is, when a species enters, what is it going to do? Not that it doesn't have a green card.
Right.
Thank you.
Should probably take a quick station ID break, and I should remind people that you are listening to the Free School University on Occupy Boston Radio, OBR.FM, on your internet browser. Occupy Boston Radio needs your support. Go to OBR.FM and click the link that says donate. Your donation will help make sure we have equipment to broadcast on and studio space to broadcast from. Don't let the voice of the 99% go silent. Support Occupy Boston Radio today. If I can move to one thing, I know a lot of, when it comes to the question of ownership of science, I mean, one of the big items in there is ownership of patents and patented results of scientific research. And one of the things that's of concern to a lot of people in the Occupy movement and outside of the Occupy movement has been the whole question of genetically modified organisms. And I know you were willing to talk to us a little bit about that. And I want to, on the one hand, it seems to me that people have been genetically modifying organisms for a very long time. Hybridization and even selective breeding are really technologies for genetically modifying organisms, aren't they? But is gene splicing and modern techniques, are they really that much worse? Are they really that much more dangerous? Or is it more a matter of the social issue of who owns the products and how that social ownership of the means of production, as it were, is going to affect us?
Yes, I think that genetically modified organisms are biological weapons against independent farmers. That's the most important consequence. There are dangers and uncertainties, because in hybridization, you cross varieties that are related to each other in the same species. That's what defines a species.
Mm-hmm.
With genetically modified organisms, you're bringing them from, you can bring them from remote species,
mm-hmm.
unrelated. That immediately gives you a great deal of uncertainty as to what they're going to do when they get there.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, the fact that you're able to introduce the gene into a particular species means that it's introducible, and therefore it can get out and get into other species as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some cases now of weeds picking up herbicide resistance from the genetically modified crops.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a lot of hype about how Monsanto could save the world. You need genetically modified crops because of hunger.
Mm-hmm.
The answer is that they compare their plant breeding, their plant modified organisms, to doing nothing, not to an ecologically rational system of food production,
mm-hmm.
which would not involve pure varieties with a particular gene, but a mosaic landscape on different scales of different kinds of crops,
mm-hmm.
plants in the same field,
mm-hmm.
plants next to each other,
mm-hmm.
Plants in other regions of the country as a backup just in case.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one concrete example of that I was reading a little bit about the other day was this golden rice stuff, which is supposed to supply, what is it, beta carotene or something. It's intended to help address vitamin A deficiencies. But one article I was reading was saying that there are plenty of, that they don't do a very good job. The golden rice at its best doesn't really provide that much vitamin A, and there are actual plants in the diet already, green leafy plants and so forth, that do a much better job of it. But they've been kind of driven out by monoculture. So introducing more monoculture of the golden rice is actually make it worse. I mean, that sounds like an example of what exactly what you were talking about.
That's right. Pumpkins are rich in carotene.
Yeah.
So it's part of the scheme to convert farmers into planting single crops for export.
Mm-hmm.
Buying the seeds from the companies that own the patents.
Because it can't, most of the seeds can't be reproduced.
That's right. And,
yep.
And the companies, the breeders, have been very careful to try to make the plants difficult to reproduce.
Mm-hmm.
And when farmers have reproduced it accidentally, they've been sued.
Mm.
There are seed police going around to see if one of their genes is in your field.
Well, one article I read said even if some pollen from somebody else's field blows into your field and now you start growing some plants that have this patented gene, that the company that patented the gene owns your plants. They can decide what you can do
with
the plants.
So that's been happening with canola in Canada and some of the other places. But when you look around at the question of patenting of plants, people have been engaged in agriculture for something like 10,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of the Neolithic times, pretty much every species that was going to be domesticated has been. So these plants have been created by the indigenous peoples of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody comes along, slaps one more gene into it,
patents
and claims that it's theirs.
Right.
So there's no justification.
No. So I guess this still is the question of whether there are benefits that are worth pursuing. I mean, and whether the danger and some of the how seriously we should take some of the technical dangers. I mean, some of the the dangers of some organism going nuts and sort of escaping into the wild and causing all kinds of havoc. I mean, it's not clear to me how you assess that danger. And then there are some claims that are made that sound pretty appealing. I mean, aren't they currently using genetically modified bacteria to grow insulin? Isn't that actually?
Oh yes, that's a very different question.
Uh huh.
Within the fermenters of a drug factory, you can use genetically modified organisms, and if anything goes wrong, you turn off the fermenter.
I see.
So within confinement, you don't have all of those dangers that we've been talking about.
Because we never have any industrial accidents in the world. Because we never have industrial accidents in the world and let things out that weren't supposed to get out.
That's true.
But yeah, it's safer than actually growing them in the field. Yeah.
Yeah. But the main danger, the main dangers of the genetically modified organisms are not the technical ones, which are real.
And I was just going to speak to the fact that that in a laboratory setting, you use genetically modified organisms all the time. At this point, E. coli essentially function as a tool to do all sorts of things in terms of moving around genes just to understand how an organism works, not necessarily to even change it. And everything at the end gets thrown into bleach or an incinerator.
Yes. So that minimizes the danger of escape.
Exactly.
It doesn't eliminate it completely.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the modifications make sure that the organism is not viable outside.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's a fail-safe
mm-hmm.
against technical errors in your handling of the beast. But I want to emphasize that the main criticism of genetically modified organisms, of things with danger, is that are there alternatives that are safe? And furthermore, are there alternatives that protect people's well-being in the large sense, socially?
Right.
So you don't judge a genetically modified organism simply by its own possible behavior.
Right.
There's no really good evidence as yet that genetically modified organisms do better than traditional varieties or varieties produced by conventional plant breeding.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know that it's better. We do know that it's potentially worse and dangerous. And we do know that economically and socially, it's bad for farmers.
Mm-hmm.
That's enough of a case.
Enough of a case to not to not use them for, yes, for in agricultural production. That's not, that doesn't apply to some of the laboratory things and the medical issues we were talking about. I guess some of the concerns that people have about just the organisms being on the market, you know, genetically modified foods in the marketplace and labeling and so forth. I mean, it sounds like you're not too worried about that kind of thing, or, I mean, a lot of people just seem to think that it's just, they're somehow inherently dangerous. If you eat a genetically modified tomato, something bad could happen.
It's better to say that they're uncertain.
It's uncertain. Yeah, okay.
There's a potential of danger to crops as well as to people. But more important than that, they're a danger to the consumers, to the array of goods that you can get.
Right.
They're a danger to the farmers.
Right.
And by pushing production for export, they're a danger to the food sovereignty of the developing world.
Of the developing world, right. And also, right, and also to the sustainability of local agricultures, because monoculture has been pretty disastrous in a lot of areas in general, right? I mean, whether it's genetically modified or not.
Yes.
I guess one of these, I mean, this issue of the ownership of science and what are the forces that we have available to fight it, other than, you know, sitting here and telling people about it over the internet and so forth? I mean, how do we try to democratize science, make it so it does more work for people and not so much for the wealthy and powerful corporations?
Well, there's teaching that can be done. Mm-hmm. And even though the big corporations have an overwhelming influence on the major research universities, there are small colleges that are not under their thumb.
Uh-huh.
Places like the College of the Atlantic, which is completely devoted to ecology.
Uh-huh.
That's one venue. Another venue is that no matter how tightly controlled the educational system is, there are enclaves of people who take an alternative approach. It's also possible for students to use the courses that they have, even which teach conventional methods and approaches,
uh-huh,
but to expand it on their own.
Uh-huh.
Make sure that their term papers deal with things beyond the boundaries of the blinkers that that the courses have. And this is all within the scientific professions.
But if you want to move to the next level beyond your undergraduate papers or even your graduate papers, you have to get research, you have to do research, and it has to be funded. So,
well, yes, and mobilization of publics is one of the ways of doing this.
Mm-hmm.
The people at Love Canal, the parents at Woburn, the people of Riverwatch,
mm-hmm,
and similar groups all over the country.
These are people that were suffering from various environmental disasters, corporate-caused environmental disasters.
For instance, the women of Woburn met in the oncology clinic at Mass General,
uh-huh,
and they discovered that they were neighbors,
uh-huh,
and their kids had leukemia,
uh-huh,
and they were getting water from the same well.
Uh-huh.
So the established science can try to poke holes in community-based research.
Uh-huh.
And it's true, it's not going to be as precise, but it makes up for it in sampling a larger range of environments over longer periods of time.
Uh-huh.
And it educates the public.
Uh-huh.
So what's needed is a return to the days of science for the people,
mm-hmm,
where young scientists mobilize along with activists who are not scientists,
mm-hmm,
in order to challenge how people are admitted into science, what they're taught when they get there, what they're allowed to research,
mm-hmm,
what kinds of results are acceptable,
mm-hmm,
what research is rewarded. All of this are issues of the social creation of science, and therefore should be part of the battleground of the Occupy movement.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, we're saying Occupy science.
I see. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. The concern I have, though, is that people tend to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, you were talking about, you made a reference at the beginning of this show to the sort of backlash against science that we're seeing from sort of the religious side, the Bible Belt, you know, creation science, so-called, and all of this. I mean, there is, I mean, science is under attack increasing, it seems like an increasing backlash, from the sort of religious right, if you want to call it that. But I also think that maybe it's lost some of its luster with some people on what you might call the left, not in the sense of the socialist left, but just the sort of broad social left. And I think there's a loss of faith in science, some of it perhaps for good reason, but maybe it goes too far. And I mean, you have a critique of the way science is done, but you have devoted your life to it, and obviously you think there's some core there that's worth salvaging, that it is a good way to know about the world and to learn more about the world. So how do we have a critique of science that's designed to make it better and that doesn't sort of play into the hands of people who want to throw the whole thing out and resort to some quote-unquote alternative way of knowing?
And I'm just going to chime in and mention that I've met several active young researchers who are also very active in terms of organizing within Occupy, which is interesting.
Organizing?
Yes. Carrying out, actually, all the biological research.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I think that for people who look at science, we have to say that it's not the golden road to absolute truth, but is a human activity.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of saying, trust us, we know, we're saying, join us and we'll find out.
Uh-huh. I mean, there is something in that core that is different than other ways of knowing about the world. I mean, it's very different to ask a question about the world and try to find the answer by looking at what really happens than it is to ask a question about the world and try to find the answer by looking in an old book. I mean, it's just a different way of thinking.
Certainly.
And to me, it's clear which one of those is better, but unfortunately it doesn't seem to be clear. There's a lot of people to whom it doesn't seem to be clear.
Well, it's important. There's no justification for being anti-science, but there's no justification for being gullible about everything it says.
Right.
And it's that kind of ambivalence that we need. Furthermore, we can have some guidelines that could help you think about science.
Mm-hmm.
One question when there's a release of a scientific report is, what do they want you to do?
I see, yeah.
Another question is, what are they leaving out?
Mm-hmm.
A third question is, are there other ways of doing this?
Mm-hmm.
Other ways of understanding?
Mm-hmm.
They didn't think so 50 years ago. Will they think so 25 years from now?
Mm-hmm.
Get a sense of science as a historically evolving human activity where you can participate being skeptical and at the same time, participant.
I mean, that's what science is supposed to be about. So science is supposed to be about being skeptical about everything. I mean, it's supposed to be about asking questions and really weighing the evidence to find answers.
In a way, that's true of our politics also. We're saying we cannot receive the existing social relations as given, necessary, and desirable.
Mm-hmm.
So we ask questions. We study our own society scientifically.
Mm-hmm.
And we can even turn the scientific tools on ourselves. And then we ask, because of our own personal histories, because of our social location in a class society, what are the typical mistakes that I will make that are different from the typical mistakes that somebody else would make?
Mm-hmm.
We have this in international cooperation, where, for instance, the typical mistakes that Cubans make now are mistakes of pragmatism.
Mm-hmm.
The urgency of having food production
mm-hmm.
in a world of rising prices.
Mm-hmm.
The typical mistakes that Americans make looking at Cuba are utopian.
Mm-hmm.
They say we want Cuba to be the inverse of all our most deeply felt miseries in our own society.
Mm-hmm. You mean Americans of the left? You're
yes,
talking about in this
that's
case.
Right.
Yeah, right.
So when the two get together, the first step is to understand where each is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
So then you can each be alert to your own and the other's typical mistakes,
mm-hmm.
and in that way, solidarity becomes more than simply saying hands off Cuba, mm-hmm. it becomes thinking together.
Mm-hmm.
Because in one sense, we certainly can't tell the Cubans what to do.
No.
It's their revolution.
Mm-hmm.
In another sense, it's also our revolution. And we have the obligation not only to protest in support of them, to oppose the blockade, mm-hmm. to struggle for the release of the Cuba Five,
mm-hmm.
but also to lend them our brains.
Mm-hmm.
There are ways in which we have advantages over Cubans in understanding issues such as racism and sexism.
Mm-hmm.
The Cuban era here...
Or homophobia.
Yes. In all of these cases, mm-hmm. the Cuban era is to think that because we are now in power, we can solve these problems through legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've neglected the monitoring of homophobia, sexism, racism.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one kind of error. Another kind is the voluntarism, which says that we've done so much, we can do everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that underestimates the warning of Rosa Luxemburg that we are building the new with the materials of the old,
mm-hmm.
including ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So how does the old survive and interfere with our building of the new?
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's an inevitable problem, that we have that old. But so the question is not how to not do it, but how to figure out how to do it right.
Yes.
Right.
So I think that a scientific attitude, which says that it's not only important, but also it's fun to
mm-hmm.
understand the world
mm-hmm.
and to act on it,
mm-hmm.
is a way of creating the sticking power in a movement. Because
mm-hmm.
for long-term radicals, this is not taking off a sabbatical to be radical.
Mm-hmm.
It's a question of finding a way of life,
mm-hmm.
Which combines attempting to understand the world and to apply that understanding
mm-hmm.
to making it a better world.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of curious, actually, Catherine, about some of the occupiers that you know who are also doing biological research and what kind of stuff they're doing. But I know you had a question for Dick, so.
Yeah, maybe I'll put that forward first, because... my question for you was, I was just wondering if you could tell me more about what you had actually mentioned before we started recording in terms of research that you had done on certain chemical agents that were used in warfare and their impact and the dialogue that took place between those researchers and the National Academy of Sciences.
Yes.
And for those that don't know, the National Academy of Sciences is, I guess, one of the senior... Well, I think you could probably explain who they are and what their impact is better than I.
Okay, I was part of a delegation to investigate birth defects induced by defoliation in Vietnam. The defoliation was occurring in South Vietnam. The analysis had to be done in the North. So women who are sprayed at various stages of pregnancy, would make the dangerous trip through the demilitarized zone because they wanted the analysis done.
Was this during the war?
During the war.
Wow, okay.
Many of them volunteered to come from their hospitals to meet with us.
Wow.
We found that there was an array of birth defects, spina bifida, hydrocephaly, and other conditions. When we brought it back to the United States, the Academy of Science was really unwilling to deal with it. For one thing, usually when you have chemical exposure, the defects that are produced are all of the same kind but different in degree, depending on the degree of exposure. Here there was all kinds of different things happening. The answer, of course, is that the defoliants were a mixture of a lot of different substances.
Mm-hmm.
But there was reluctance to even take up the question. Then veterans began reporting the effects of exposure to defoliation and having children with birth defects. Finally, the Veterans Administration had to get interested, and it's now pretty much recognized that the defoliants are damaging to the development of children. But while on the subject, I'd like to add one more point about analysis of variability under stress. In theoretical work, we and others have shown that if organisms are at the boundary of their tolerance in unusual circumstances, then there's more variation from one to the next, more variation within a neighborhood, within a field, within a forest. So even the width of the tree rings at the edge of a forest will show more variation than the width of tree rings in the middle of the forest where it's sheltered. Well, this applies to people as well. We found that in if you look at those counties that are poor, the variation in the prevalence of disease from county to county is greater than in the well-to-do counties. Or if you look at infant mortality in the Afro-American population from city to city, the variation from city to city is greater than for whites over the same set of cities. Mm-hmm. Now, this is not saying only that they have more disease rates or that their health is impaired, which we know, but also that the variability is greater.
Right. So, and just to paraphrase that, you're saying the circumstances that they're exposed to are so extreme that you begin to see those individuals that are able to withstand that versus those individuals that just are going to have a more difficult time once things are pushed to that
That's
threshold.
Right. Yes. So conservatives can look at that data, and what they will say is, well, you see, even in the worst circumstances, not everybody gets sick. And I grew up in a ghetto, and now I'm a Supreme Court judge.
So therefore, they blame the individual.
For the individual. They talk about inadequate mothering.
Mm-hmm.
Our point of view from the ecological perspective is that living under those conditions, you have to be perfect to get by.
Mm-hmm.
Any slightest thing will produce differences.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a perfect shopper and collect all the green stamps, can find a babysitter while you look for bargains, can afford transport to the better stores, there's a whole series of conditions.
You also have to be lucky,
not
just perfect. I mean,
that's
you,
right.
You have to be perfect, but your parents also have to be perfect or something. I mean, you need more than just your own virtue to make it.
So here's an example where the same observation can lead you to very different directions. One says, therefore, blame the individual. The other says, change the social conditions, which make people so vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
So that trivial differences between them that you can't even identify mm-hmm. can nevertheless make the difference between living and dying.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So that's work, and that's a way in which research with corn is relevant to the struggles for public health.
And that's interesting that you added in that element, David, that it's not just the individual, but it has to do with how also the people that are close to that individual respond to stress, their partner or their parent that mm-hmm. they might be dependent on or that they might be taking care of, that would also, under those sorts of circumstances, that could factor into their own welfare depending on how far they are willing to put themselves out there to compensate for the other
That's
person's
right.
difficulties.
I mean, I'm not a biologist like you two, but if I would translate into ecological terms, I would come up with something like if you have a situation where an organism is subject to a high level of stress and small variations can make a difference on how they respond, then small variations in sort of micro environment can make a big difference too. So whether you have a certain person in your life that can help you in a certain way, you just didn't get lucky and have that person in your life, makes a huge difference, and it's nothing to do with your individual value as a person.
So this brings us then to two propositions which are contradictory and which separately are false but together true. One says you are responsible for your own health.
Mm-hmm.
The other one says the community is responsible for the health of people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you accept the idea that you're responsible for your own health and you don't have the means to tap into the high-tech medicine and the best medical care, then that claim is simply frustrating mm-hmm. and demoralizing.
Mm-hmm.
If you say that the community is responsible for the health of the people, but the community is poor, disorganized, and you don't have a way of getting it together, that's also demoralizing. But if you say the community is responsible for the health of the population, we will join together to track down sources of pollution, sources of poverty, and so on. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, we can take our health into our own hands personally as well as collectively. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be true then. The two propositions jointly are true, mm-hmm. but separately they can be demoralizing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that seems to... you tell me I got 5 minutes. My watch says I'm right on the money here. Yeah, but we got people coming in behind us. We got people rattling the door. We got to wrap up, I think. We could go on for a long time, but I think actually, Dick, you left us on a good note. That was a good place to end. You've been listening to the Free School University and Occupy Boston Radio, educational programming by the 99% for the 99%. And we've been talking about who owns science and a lot of related issues with Richard Levins. So that's it for tonight's show. Join us next week. We'll be talking to actor and writer Harlan Baker about labor history and his one-man show, Jimmy Higgins, A Life in the Labor Movement. I hope you won't confuse us with an episode of OBR's arts show, The Bridge. Just remember that I'm the one with the Boston accent and Linda Carmichael's the one with the British accent. Same time, Wednesday, 7 to 8 p.m., USA Eastern Time, and same station, obr.fm on your internet browser.
Thank you, David, and I think she might be Scottish.
Oh, well, Great Britain, the British Isles. She's one with an accent from the British Isles. My ear, my Boston accent ear isn't good enough to distinguish.
I think that wraps us up. Thank you so much, both David, and thank you for joining our show, Dr. Levins. Dick.
It's been a pleasure to be here with you.
You have been listening to a Free School University program that originally broadcast on August 8, 2012. The Free School University program is educational programming by the 99% for the 99%. Please join us every Wednesday at 7 p.m. USA Eastern Time on Occupy Boston Radio, obr.fm on your internet browser.